His disappearances all those years ago was another woman, or even another family. But it was always so random, Amy said, the one and only time they discussed it, when they were both at the right level of drunkenness to bring up their father's former habit. So arbitrary. Exactly, said Troy. It seemed arbitrary to us because he needed an excuse to see his girlfriend. We were walking on eggshells trying not to upset him when he'd already decided ahead of time that something stupid and meaningless was about to upset him. That would be too cruel, Amy had said. Well, it was cruel, said Troy, and he'd been surprised and embarrassed by the break in his voice. What he did was cruel. But all that had happened such a long time ago, when everything was different, their clothes, their hairstyles, their bodies, their personalities. If he saw old footage of himself, he couldn't believe he'd ever spoken at such a high pitch or with such an uncouth, flat-vowed drawl. His parents were no longer those people. Now they were smaller, weaker, less impressive, no longer in charge of anything, not even the tennis school. Once he'd run late, meeting them for dinner, and when he got there, his eyes skimmed right on past the elderly couple in the corner, and he'd kept looking for his parents, his huge, intimidating father, his energetic, tiny mother. And then he saw the elderly couple waving at him, dissolving into his parents, like that optical illusion where you saw either the old hag or the beautiful girl, and once you knew the trick, you could see both. It became a choice. He could choose to see a vile old sleaze making a move on a young girl, or a pathetic elderly man trying to reclaim his lost youth. He could choose to see the father who had chosen to believe Harry Haddad over him, or he could choose to see the father who appeared like magic, huge and hairy in his boxer shorts, there to slay the monster, the moment Troy screamed, "Daddy!" from his bed. But then he grew out of his nightmares, and it was his mother who kept coming to his rescue after his dad gave up on him because of Harry fucking Haddad. It was his mother who charmed school principals and police officers. She was the one who helped get him back on the track that had led directly to this enviable life he now lived. He had to ensure his mother never heard about what his father had done. He had to save her, the way his mother had always saved him, and in doing so, he would give his father the pardon that he never gave Troy. "You must not tell my mother," said Troy.
"Like I said," Savannah placed her hands on her knees, "I'm still trying to decide."
And now he got it. Why she'd come to him and not one of his siblings, and why she was behaving like this was a business transaction. She was here to make a deal. Chapter 34. Who can explain the difference between active and passive listening? Logan asked his Wednesday afternoon class. Passive listening, that word again. Was that the way he'd listened to Indira? Passively? A motley mix of students sat at the semicircle of desks surrounding him. Teenagers straight out of school, women looking to get back into an unrecognisable workforce after years spent raising children, older men who had worked all their lives in industries that no longer existed. "Active listening is the way I listen to my husband," said star student Rani. "Passive listening is the way he listens to me." A few women chuckled. The teenagers glanced up briefly from their phones and then instantly dropped their heads again, as if there were magnets on their foreheads. Rani was only a few years younger than Logan's mother, and she was retraining to get back into the workforce after she and her husband had lost all their money to a charming, fraudulent financial advisor now doing prison time. "We thought this man was the bee's knees," Rani had said in her About Me presentation at the beginning of the semester. "We mortgaged our home to invest with him. It was like we were under his spell." Rani's sparkly demeanour reminded Logan of his mother, and Logan wondered now if Joy might one day describe Savannah as someone they once thought of as the bee's knees. His mother was spellbound by her, or at least by her cooking, but Joy was astute when it came to money. There was no way she'd mortgage the house for Savannah. Or would she? In return for a roast chicken lunch. As Logan's class brainstormed techniques for active listening, verbal affirmations like, "Yes, I see," and nonverbal affirmations like nodding your head, he thought about how Amy had said their mother was furious when she heard of Logan's doubts about Savannah's story. Logan was kind of furious with Amy. Telling their mother was not the plan. "You were going to ask Savannah out for a drink," Logan reminded her. "I know," said Amy, "but she gives me the heebie-jeebies. She didn't even want to let me in the door. It was like she was their carer." Logan had forgotten that you could never rely on Amy to stick to a plan. "To be fair, she does make excellent minestrone," Amy had said. "Simon and I had two bowls each." Simon, it transpired, was Amy's flatmate, and for some unexplained reason, he had been at their parents' house too. Simon was going to help Amy do a deep dive on Savannah. "A full-on background check," Amy told Logan, "like the FBI would do." "Right," said Logan, "because he's an accountant." "How does that help?" said Logan. "He's very thorough," Amy said, and then she chuckled suggestively. And Logan had hung up and called Brooke, who said not to waste any more time with Amy, and that she herself had begun preparing a dossier on Savannah weeks ago, and she'd come back to Logan with some proper information soon. She said the word dossier with a lot of satisfaction. Troy hadn't returned anyone's calls, and for all anyone knew, might have been out of the country, so he was no help. In the meantime, their mother had taken Savannah shopping last week and bought her a whole new wardrobe, which was upsetting for Amy and Brooke. Not because they wanted to go shopping with their mother, they couldn't think of anything worse, but what with Savannah's incessant baking and her tiny feet, the girl was clearly intent upon transforming herself into their mother's dream daughter. "Let's role play some active and passive listening," said Logan to his class. He didn't ask for volunteers. He chose Brian, an Irish automotive worker who had lost his job of 30 years when Holden closed its doors, and June, a bright, bubbly hairdresser who wanted her boss's job because her boss was a real B-I-T-C-H. "Tell June a story, Brian," said Logan, "about anything. And June, I want you to be a passive listener." Brian launched into a story about a grossly unfair parking ticket, which June found impossible to listen to passively because she'd been booked at the exact same intersection near the college. So had Logan. Brian's Irish accent became more pronounced the more excited and upset he became, and Logan was reminded of Savannah's similarly Irish-accented boyfriend, sitting up in bed, reaching for his spectacles, the terror on his face. He stopped dead and banged the whiteboard marker against his palm. The source of truth, or at least another version of the truth. He'd go talk to the little Irish fucker. Later that afternoon, Logan stood at the apartment building where Savannah had lived with her boyfriend. He remembered the apartment number because his birthday was on the 24th, so he'd always had a fondness for the number. "Hello?" said an Irish-accented voice. "Hello?" Logan panicked. He hadn't thought it through. But the man said instantly, impatiently, "Come on up, second floor." The security buzzer went, and in his relief, Logan pushed the glass door so hard it crashed against the wall with a bang. When he got to the apartment, he saw that the door had been propped open with a battered old sneaker. Logan tentatively pushed open the door. "Hello?" Nothing. He could hear music playing from somewhere inside. Nora Jones. It was like the guy was doing everything possible to make himself look benign. Savannah had mentioned his name, but Logan was struggling to remember it. Something bland and one syllable. He looked at the abstract painting leaning against the wall. It was god-awful. Indira would love it. He remembered when he and Troy first came here, Savannah had said the boyfriend was the artist. He studied the signature. Did it possibly say David? Was that the bloke's name? Dave? Dave. Dave? He called out. A voice called over the music. "Yeah, thank you. Just leave it anywhere." He walked into the dining room. It was like walking onto a building site, albeit one with Nora Jones crooning from a speaker. A giant paint-stained tarpaulin protected the carpet. The unpacked removalists' boxes had been stacked in a corner, and the coffee table had been tipped on its side and propped up against the wall. Dave, he assumed his name was Dave, stood in front of a giant easel. He was in the process of squeezing paint from a tube onto a piece of cardboard he was using as a palette. He wore a mechanic's blue boiler suit. There was a blob of paint on his glasses, another on his earlobe. The canvas he was working on featured swirls of queasy yellow, similar to the colour of Logan's kitchen. The mood in the apartment was industrious and joyful. This was someone completely lost in something they loved to do, and Logan found himself feeling envious. He'd once lost himself in tennis, and then only sex and television. Now there was only television left. Indira wanted to paint. Like this, maybe. Logan wasn't sure. She told him this about a year ago, as if she were confessing to something deeply personal and private. "Go for it," Logan had told her. She said she needed somewhere to paint and that maybe they could think about moving to a bigger place where she could have a studio. "Just do it right here," Logan had said, and he'd pushed the coffee table up against the wall. Not passive listening, active listening, very active listening. It was a heavy coffee table. The woman wants to paint, the man makes space for her to paint. But she'd said, sadly, "No, that won't work." And then she stopped talking about it. If she really wanted to paint, she'd have painted. Look at this guy. This apartment had half their living space. "Yeah, hi, thanks for that. Did you need something?" said Dave. He replaced the lid on his tube of paint. "I'm Logan." His mind was still on Indira. Logan was totally supportive of her desire to paint. He just didn't want to sell the townhouse. Just in case it didn't work out. No, absolutely not. That was not the reason. He was committed to the relationship. But sometimes you lost when you were meant to win. The townhouse was in his name. If it didn't work out, nothing needed to change. The girl left. Logan stayed. And see, look what happened. The girl had left. Once again, his strategy was sound. "Yeah, thanks, Logan," said Dave, a bit impatiently. "So the pizza is..." He looked over Logan's shoulder. "Oh, said Logan apologetically. I'm not delivering pizza. I'm, hoping you might talk to me about your girlfriend. Your ex-girlfriend, Savannah? Just quickly?
He remembered his strategy. Ask for help. Throw himself at his mercy.
I need your help. Dave took a step backward. Fuck. He put down his tube of paint. You're one of the angry guys who came with her that day.
Logan had a sick feeling that the poor guy was urgently scanning the room looking for a weapon with which to defend himself. He was even younger and smaller than Logan remembered. Logan lifted his palms.
I come in peace.
What in the world? He tried to stoop and round his shoulders to make himself smaller and less intimidating.
I just want to talk. Savannah is staying with my parents.
Your parents? Dave had picked up a paintbrush, which he clenched in his fist as if he might stab Logan with the pointy end.
She's staying with her parents? Not you. And she's okay?
She's fine, said Logan. He thought of Savannah gliding about his mother's kitchen with his mother's haircut.
She's good.
How does she know your family?
Asked Dave.
She doesn't.
I don't get it.
She turned up on their doorstep late one night, bleeding. She said that you hit her.
Hit her?
Dave's mouth dropped. His face became stupid with shock.
She really said that? That I hit her?
That's why my brother and I came here to help her pick up her stuff. But then the other day, I saw something on TV. It was a girl telling the same story as Savannah told me. About you. Almost word for word. It made me think she might have made it up. And, well, that's fine if she made it up.
It wasn't fine if she made it up, but he wanted to be clear that he was an easygoing, accepting kind of guy. All he wanted was information.
She's living with my parents, and my mother loves her, and I guess we're just trying to understand.
He felt suddenly overcome by the peculiarity of this whole situation. He'd walked into a stranger's apartment, just like Savannah had walked into his parents' life. People weren't meant to behave like this. We just need to know if we should be worried. We don't quite get her.
The kid's shoulders dropped.
Right, he said. Right then.
He took off his glasses and cleaned off the paint from the lenses with an old rag from his pocket.
Well, firstly, I did not hit her. I've never hit anyone.
He looked up at Logan. Man or woman.
Okay, said Logan. I believe you.
Is that why you two looked like you wanted to kill me that day?
Dave put his glasses back on and peered at Logan. Because you believed I'd...
We didn't want to kill you, said Logan uncomfortably. Your brother did. It was a nightmare, like a home invasion.
You were apologizing to her. You kept saying sorry to Savannah, remembered Logan. He kind of wanted to find mitigating circumstances. You were apologizing for something you'd done, something pretty bad.
Not for hitting her, said Dave. I was apologizing for forgetting her birthday. I was meant to meet her at a restaurant for her birthday, and I never showed. She was all dressed up in this fancy restaurant, waiting, and my phone battery was dead.
Wow, said Logan.
I know, said Dave. He shook his head remorsefully. I still can't believe I did that.
So, this story, she told me,
she probably did repeat it from something she saw on TV. She does that, like
monologues from movies, stories that people told her, or that I told her. She's like a parrot. It's her party trick.
Okay, said Logan. Some party trick, pretending you're a victim of domestic violence.
Supposedly, she has this thing called superior memory syndrome, or something like that. She says she can remember every day of her whole life. I never knew if that was true, or even that was something she'd seen on TV.
He looked uneasy.
She could be kind of loose with the truth.
She's a liar, said Logan. That's what you're saying.
The apartment buzzer rang and they both jumped. That's my pizza, said Dave. I thought you were my pizza.
Yeah, I got that, said Logan.
You mind if I let him come up?
Asked Dave carefully, as if he were being held hostage. Logan took a step back, held his palms up again, idiotically.
I won't take up much more of your time.
Dave buzzed in the pizza guy, and then they both looked at each other awkwardly, waiting.
What sort of pizza? Asked Logan.
My favourite, from my local, said Dave. It's called the Saucy Stripper. Chicken strips and sweet chili sauce.
You hungry? I won't eat it all.
Starving, said Logan honestly.
But that's okay. I won't.
Family-sized saucy stripper for Dave?
Called out a deep voice at the door. And Logan and Dave grinned in mutual involuntary appreciation, which somehow lifted the mood. And that was how Logan found himself sitting on the floor of Savannah's ex-boyfriend's apartment, drinking beer and eating excellent pizza, and strangely enjoying himself.
My girlfriend wants to paint this sort of stuff, art.
Logan gestured at the easel.
My ex-girlfriend.
He looked about the room.
I said she could just paint in our living area like you're doing. She said she needed a studio.
He wanted Dave to say, high maintenance.
Yeah, well, I'm only doing it here because Savannah moved out, said Dave. Otherwise, I'd need my own space. That's the silver lining of her leaving. I've suddenly got my own studio.
Your girlfriend couldn't paint with you breathing down her neck.
I wouldn't have done that, said Logan. She would have felt embarrassed to paint in front of you.
Dave peeled off a piece of chicken from his pizza and spoke with his mouth full,
especially if she's only just getting started. That's the thing about art. It's so visible.
Oh, said Logan. She never said. I could have gone out. Left her to it.
Sure, said Dave, but she probably got it in her head that a studio was the answer to overcoming her fear. She wants to paint, but she's afraid to paint.
Why would she be afraid to paint?
In case she's no good, said Dave. In case she can't get what's in her head and her heart onto the canvas. Maybe she's afraid of being afraid. That she'll be so paralysed by fear she won't do a thing. She'll just stand there with her paintbrush, feeling like a fraud.
Logan put down his slice of pizza, suddenly bereft. He'd thought it was just a passing whim, and the truth was Indira became weirdly reticent each time she brought it up, as if she didn't really care all that much. She'd raise it, and then she'd instantly back down. She never pushed that hard. Was it possible the reticence was because of fear? He should have understood that she could have passionate, complicated feelings about art, just like he had passionate, complicated feelings about tennis. Art wasn't a hobby for Indira, like tennis could never be a hobby for him. When she walked through art galleries, she felt what Logan felt when he watched the Grand Slams. Pain and pleasure, like unrequited love. He was a fool. They could have afforded a bigger place. Why did he insist they stay? Because he never felt like changing anything. His job, his address, his bank, his gym. Jesus, it would have been so simple to move to a two-bedroom place with a second room she could have used as a studio. She could have closed the door, faced her fear. She was probably good, probably better than this guy. She was probably great.
Did she break your heart then? Asked Dave.
No, said Logan. It just ran its course. He changed the subject back to the point of his visit. How long had you been with Savannah?
It was only early days, said Dave. About 3 months.
You moved in together pretty fast, commented Logan.
Probably too fast, agreed Dave. I told her on one of our very first dates that I'd been thinking of moving to Sydney, and she said she'd been planning to do the same, but it was so much more expensive than Adelaide.
Wait, she told us you both moved down from the Gold Coast together.
Adelaide, said Dave.
Why would she say the Gold Coast?
Did coming from the Gold Coast sound more tragic and dramatic than coming from Adelaide?
Maybe it did.
Dave shrugged. She did that. It's a habit of hers. She lies about things for no reason. Things that don't matter. That are easy to catch her out on. Like, I don't know, what she'd had for lunch. I'd say, but Savannah, I know that's not true. And she'd say, what does it matter? It's so trivial. Who cares what I had for lunch? And I'd think, yeah, it is trivial. I don't care. But it made me feel kind of befuddled.
I bet, said Logan.
Dave helped himself to another slice of pizza and said, you know, I did some research. Savannah actually fits the definition of a pathological liar, which is someone who lies when there's no benefit to lying. That's exactly what she'd do. Lie for the sake of it.
Logan tried to channel his mother and show compassion. I guess it might have something to do with her growing up in foster care. He warmed to the subject. She maybe got used to saying whatever she thought people wanted to hear and...
Yeah, no, mate, said Dave. She didn't grow up in foster care.
Logan slumped back.
She didn't?
His compassion vanished.
No, said Dave. Her father died when she was a baby. I don't think they ever had much money, but she definitely was never in foster care. She'd lived in the same house from when she was 7. She used to do ballet. She says her mother still has all her trophies displayed, like a shrine to her ballet career. I know that part is true. I've seen photos of her performing.
Logan felt queasy. All these unnecessary lies. Had she stolen the details of her childhood in foster care from some poor contestant describing their journey on a talent show? None of it was necessary to arouse Logan's mother's sympathy. She could have just admitted she was an ordinary girl from Adelaide who had been stood up by her boyfriend on her birthday, and Logan's mother still would have let her stay the night. Although perhaps Logan's father would not have let her stay the second night.
So that night when you forgot her birthday, is that when she left?
Another thought struck Logan. How did she hurt herself then? She was bleeding when she got to my parents.
So I worked late. I'm the new guy, trying to impress.
He lifted his bottle to his mouth, took a long swig. He was loosening up now that he'd nearly finished his beer, becoming voluble.
We'd both got new jobs straight away when we moved in, so we were busy. I was working full-time as a graphic designer, and Savannah was working odd hours at 2 jobs.
We were both exhausted. Savannah had two jobs. What happened to those two jobs? The last Logan had heard was that Savannah had said there wasn't much out there right now. I had in my head that the birthday dinner was another week away, so I got home and my phone was flat and I couldn't find the damn charger. We'd only just moved in. We still had boxes to unpack. I was getting hungry because she does all the cooking. Dave dolefully considered his slice of pizza. She's a great cook.
I know, said Logan. Although it felt wrong to admit he'd enjoyed Savannah's cooking while he was here investigating her.
And then, finally, she came home. I thought, yes, dinner. But then I saw she was all dressed up, and I said, oh, fuck, it's not today, is it? Like, it was obviously the first time we'd celebrated her birthday together. So it was a real balls up. He clearly still felt bad about it. It's strange, because she didn't seem that angry at first. She was upset, but not crazy angry. She said it didn't matter. We'd go there again another time. She made pasta. We were watching TV, having a glass of wine. It was all good. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, it was like she lost her mind. She stood up from the couch and said, I can't take this anymore. She was walking back and forth, holding her wine, and it was like she was having some kind of episode. And we still had boxes and shit everywhere. Next thing, she trips over my guitar case. She'd asked me to move it out of the way, and I never did. He looked at Logan. I'm officially the lowlife in this story. Logan sucked his teeth sympathetically, which was a good example of a non-verbal affirmation while active listening. The wine glass smashed when she fell, and she cut herself. He put a hand over his own eye as he remembered. I thought she'd lost an eye for a moment. All that blood. I was trying to help her, and she wouldn't let me look at it. She was turning in circles, muttering to herself. Next thing, she just left. Bare feet. It was a cold night. No money, no phone. Gone. Where did you think she'd gone? I had no idea. I said, where are you going? And she said, I'm going back there. Going back where? Said Logan. That's what I said. Going back where? I assumed she meant going back to Adelaide. I said, you can't get a flight at this time of night. Logan studied him, looking for the holes in the story that his sisters would find. You must have been worried. I didn't know whether I should call the police or what. I didn't sleep. But then the next day I went to work. It's a new job. I had to work. And she'd left this weird whispered message on my voicemail, like she was calling from a library. She said she was staying with old friends. And I thought, what friends? I didn't think we knew anyone here. She said that she wished me well. I took that to mean we were done. Logan winced. She wished you well. I know, said Dave. That was the way she talked sometimes, like an old lady, or like she was playing a part. I feel like I never even knew her. And you know, since then, I've talked to people about it, and I just think, man, that's one of those short relationships where you look back and think, what was that all about? Because she was fun and sweet, but she was weird. I think maybe I dodged a bullet. Maybe you did, said Logan. Was that dodged bullet now headed straight for his parents? I don't think she's dangerous, reflected Dave. She's just a really strange person. That night, her behaviour was weird, so out of the blue. I remember thinking, is this actually nothing to do with me missing her birthday? Was it something on TV that upset her? But it couldn't have been. We weren't even really watching it. It was just some random news story about tennis.
Tennis? Said Logan sharply. He'd been about to have a mouthful of beer, and the bottle banged against his teeth. What about tennis?
Savannah has less than zero interest in sport, so it couldn't have been that.
But you said there was something on TV about tennis. What about tennis?
Dave shook his head adamantly, trying to make it clear that Logan had the wrong end of the stick.
It was nothing, he said. Just something about that player making a comeback. What's his name?
He frowned, snapped his fingers.
Harry Haddad.
Chapter 35. Now.
I just think if we tell the police everything about Savannah, it might distract them from finding Mum,
said the client in the reception area of Marshall and Smith, criminal defence lawyers.
It will make them think Dad has a possible...
She lowered her voice.
A possible motive.
The receptionist, who had been at Marshall and Smith for over a decade, was used to overhearing conversations like this of a personal and sometimes salacious nature. It was a perk of the job. The client, a woman who had very short hair but was a noticeably long person, she seemed double the length of an average woman, like someone about to stride out onto a field and win the gold medal for high jump, was here for a first appointment with the senior partner, Chris Marshall. She was speaking quietly into her phone, but the receptionist had excellent hearing, which was not her fault.
If they work it out themselves, that's fine. I mean, we worked it out ourselves. I'm sure they're more efficient investigators than us. I just don't see why we need to hand it to them on a platter. It's not relevant. It just makes Dad look bad.
There was a long pause, and then she suddenly said,
Well, that's up to you, Troy. I can't stop you, but you may as well know that I'm finding Dad a lawyer, just in case.
Another pause.
Yes, I'm standing by him.
Another pause.
No, I didn't say I'm standing by him no matter what.
Her voice was full of suppressed emotion.
I'm just trying to do the right thing. Oh, go to hell.
She dropped the phone into her lap and looked straight ahead. The receptionist lowered her eyes to her keyboard. It was awkward to witness another person lose control.
Brooke Delaney?
Chris Marshall stood at the door of his office, smiling expensively.
That's me. The woman leaped to her feet, breathed through her nostrils, and lifted her chin, as if she were about to set that high jump record, and went striding into his office.
Chapter 36. Last October. Do a reverse image search, suggested the internet, when Brooke asked how one would go about doing a background search on a suspicious person staying with one's parents.
It's easy.
Not if I don't have a photo of her, Brooke told the internet. She locked her hands together and raised them high above her head. She was sitting at her desktop computer in her study at home, except it felt like she was sitting in Grant's study at Grant's computer in Grant's home. It had technically been a shared study, but Brooke had been the one who always worked on her laptop at the dining room table, as if Grant's career was the one that mattered. It had felt more important, although she didn't know why Grant's work as a geologist in the government geoscience department should be more important than hers as a physiotherapist. Why was she thinking this? Grant had never once implied that his work was more important than hers. He also had bad posture, so he needed the chair with better lumbar support. That was absolutely her choice. She'd insisted on it, in fact.
Her marriage had been an equal modern partnership, nothing like her parents' lopsided, old-fashioned marriage. It had been a shock to hear her mother say she hated cooking. No wonder Joy thought Grant was so wonderful. Grant was a great cook. They had never had a single argument over who did what around the house. It just wasn't an issue for them. Everything was split so fairly. Brooke was nothing like her mother. Nothing. She readjusted the chair to suit herself. It was a good chair. Grant's lower back probably missed it. She turned up the volume on Taylor Swift to inspire her. She loved Taylor Swift. Grant said she couldn't possibly love Taylor because she wasn't 13. But she did so love her. It was kind of a relief not to have to sit and listen to the latest album from an alternative rock band Grant had discovered. You had to listen to the full album in the correct order because that was what the artist intended. Brooke just liked to listen to her favourite song on repeat. Brooke had Googled Savannah weeks ago, as soon as she got her full name. Initially, her mother said she didn't know it. I didn't ask. Why would I ask? Yes, indeed. Why would you ask for the full name of the person who has moved into your home? And then her mother said her name was Savannah Polanski, just like that dreadful film director. And nothing had come up for Savannah Polanski except an obituary. And then, days later, oh, actually, I got that wrong. It's not Polanski, it's Pagonis. Brooke had Googled again, and still nothing turned up except for a 3-star review of a sushi restaurant in Byron Bay. Now she stared with blank frustration at the computer screen. She was used to the internet providing all the answers she needed. Wait, Brooke did have a photo of Savannah. Her mother had texted her a photo of them on their shopping trip, a selfie of the two of them looking radiantly happy wearing new dresses, tags dangling in a change room. The photo was in focus, so Savannah must have been the one to take it and hold the phone steady. Apparently, they'd spent 6 hours at the shopping centre. They stayed so long they would have had to have paid extra for parking if Savannah hadn't discovered some extraordinary loophole regarding parking validation, which saved them $7. They had apple crumble. It wasn't bad. Brooke had been irritated by the photo and the shopping expedition. Now she found the photo on her phone, cropped out Savannah's face, and did her first reverse image search. The internet said, "That's not Savannah Pagonis, that's Savannah Smith." 2 years ago, Savannah Smith had been photographed at the bookstore launch of a celebrity chef's new recipe book. It was definitely Savannah, although her style had changed dramatically. Her hair was longer and curlier then, and she wore bright red lipstick and big earrings. But what did that tell Brooke? That Savannah once had a different surname and hairstyle? A former marriage? It was hardly shocking that Savannah had been at the launch of a recipe book. Brooke sighed. She shouldn't be disappointed. She didn't want to find out that her parents were living with a serial con artist, did she? Maybe she did. Maybe she was hoping for an excuse to drive over there and yell at Savannah, "You stop being so nice to my parents!" She looked at the time. She kept forgetting that her friend Inez would be turning up soon. Word had recently got out about the separation. Not thanks to her, she'd told no one except her family, and people had begun to message Brooke their condolences, as if Grant had died. Inez's text had been brief. "Just heard. I'll come over tonight." Brooke texted back, "I might have plans." Inez texted, "No, you don't." Well, it was true. Her only plan had been to investigate Savannah and write an article, 10 Tips for Back Pain, in the hope that she could get it placed on a women's health website. She was trying to build her profile. She also needed to do a new, engaging post on Instagram. She kept Googling Savannah Smith, trawling through multiple wrong Savannah Smiths across the world until she stopped on a grainy black and white image from a newspaper article dated 15 years earlier. The headline read, 11-year-old Savannah dances into a bright future. It was only a very short one-paragraph story from a local newspaper in Adelaide about how Savannah Smith had won first place in the biggest ballet competition in the region and how it was a great thrill for the quiet, shy, talented little girl because it was her dream to one day dance professionally. The photo on Brooke's screen showed a little girl in a tutu, up on her toes, arms above her head in that classic ballerina pose. A very skinny, almost skeletal, intense, serious-looking little girl with her hair pulled so tightly back from her head in a bun that it looked painful. Her elf-like ears stuck out. She didn't have the right ears for a ballet dancer. Years ago, there had been similarly hyperbolic newspaper stories about the future tennis careers of Brooke and all three of her siblings. It happened all the time. Talented kids turned into ordinary grown-ups. Butterflies became moths. Apparently, her dad had a project underway where he was carefully laminating every single one of their ancient press clippings for posterity, which made Brooke feel melancholy. What a monumental waste of time. Something about the photo tugged irritably at Brooke's memory. The little girl reminded her of someone or something in the past, something to do with a migraine, her vision blurring, the smell of fresh-cut grass, someone shouting. The doorbell rang and she jumped, startled out of her reverie. Inez arrived with a bottle of champagne and an overloaded recycled shopping bag looped over one shoulder. "Too heavy," said Brooke as she swiftly removed it and led Inez to the kitchen, suddenly filled with affection for her old friend. She hadn't forgotten her friends, but it did strangely feel as though she was just now remembering them. "Love the overalls," said Inez, indicating Brooke's blue denim overalls, which she'd pulled out from the back of a drawer on a whim. "Very retro." "They're comfortable," said Brooke. "Grant said they made me look like a zookeeper." They opened the champagne and Brooke filled her in on everything Savannah. "She's been doing all the cooking for them."
"What a low life."
Inez handed her a fizzing glass of champagne. Brooke giggled and then stopped abruptly because she realized how the sound and feel of that voluptuous giggle was both familiar and unfamiliar, like something she'd thought she'd packed away forever along with her old school books and uniform. This had been happening more and more as the weeks went by and Grant's presence became fainter. Brooke was discovering old habits, old clothes, old music, and now, her old laugh. It was absurd to think she hadn't laughed in 10 years. She certainly had laughed because Grant was funny. So funny. He was proud of his wit. It was important to him that he be recognized as the funny one in their relationship. Inez said suddenly, "It's really nice to see you." "I know, I've been so busy with the clinic," Inez interrupted. "I meant, it's nice to see you without Grant."
"What do you mean? You liked Grant, didn't you? Everyone liked Grant."
Brooke looked at the bottle of champagne.
"Wait, is this champagne celebratory?"
"I didn't dislike him," said Inez. "He's one of those people you feel like you should like."
She paused.
"It just always felt like you were concentrating."
"Concentrating?"
"Like you were very aware of him."
"Isn't that just being a good partner? Being aware of the other person?"
"Sure.
but it seemed like it only went one way. I never felt like he was concentrating on you. It was like he was the CEO and you were his devoted assistant.
No, said Brooke. She was a strong, smart, educated woman who had no problem with flat tires, spiders, light globes, overcharging mechanics, or tough-talking real estate agents. She was deeply offended. That's not true. That is absolutely not true.
I'm sure it's not, said Inez steadily. What would I know? They silently drank their champagne.
I'm sorry, said Inez. That was a stupid thing to say. Look, I'll show you what I bought. She heaved up the grocery bag onto the counter. I got mood-boosting foods. Salmon, bananas. I seem to remember you were always eating bananas at school.
I did love bananas, said Brooke. But then one doctor told me to cut them out in case they were triggering my migraines, so I stopped eating them.
She took the bunch of bright yellow bananas from Inez.
Sugar bananas, she said vaguely, as a memory from childhood materialized, the image becoming slowly clearer like a developing photo. She was in her winter school uniform, dropping her school bag on the back veranda and running to rescue a tennis ball from the mouth of their extremely naughty black Labrador. When she came back to retrieve her bag, a strange kid was on the back veranda, which was nothing new. There were always strange kids in their backyard, stealing their parents' attention. Except this one was rifling through Brooke's bag, helping herself to a banana. An unbruised sugar banana, Brooke had run out of time to eat at school, but one she still had every intention of eating. And there were flashing lights in Brooke's eyes that she didn't yet understand, but every time she told her mother about them, she was too busy to listen, too busy with other kids, like this one. And how dare this stupid, strange kid go through Brooke's bag and steal her banana? Brooke felt enraged, violated, sick to the stomach. She'd yelled, "Hey, you, put it down. That's my bag. That's my banana." Brooke had never been a yeller. She was more of a sulker. It had been almost exciting to know she had the ability to yell as loudly as that, with righteous fury. The little girl looked up. Hair pulled back so tightly off her forehead, her eyes were pulled into cat's eyes. Elfin ears, resentful face. She dropped the banana. Run away. That's why Brooke had recognized that little girl's face in the article. She'd met Savannah as a child. It was no coincidence that she'd turned up at her family home. She'd been there before.
Chapter 37. Now. So, the bananas sparked this memory, said Inez Lang to her mother as they waited at the menswear counter to buy her dad a new tie for his birthday. It was just after she and Grant, sweet Jesus, speak of the actual devil. Inez couldn't believe it. Don't turn around. She dropped her gaze, but it was too late. He was heading towards them, threading his way past the racks of clothes.
Inez, I thought it was you.
Brooke's ex-husband, Grant Willis, was an ordinary-looking guy with a receding hairline and large ears, yet he carried himself as if he were a sex symbol, and he almost became as good-looking as he believed himself to be. Women awarded extra points for self-confidence. Men weren't as generous with their marking.
Hi, Grant, said Inez. Not rude, but frosty. Mum, this is Brooke's ex-husband.
Hold your horses, we're not divorced yet, said Grant. But you will be, said Inez. She said to her mother, they will be.
We're not focusing on that right now, said Grant, with Brooke's mother missing. He looked momentarily uncertain.
I'm really fond of Joy. We were close.
Aren't you living in Melbourne now, Grant? Asked Inez. Brooke had told her that he'd accepted an interstate secondment earlier in the year. Inez and Brooke had agreed this was good news. It was preferable ex-husbands left the state, if not the country or the planet. So why was he lurking around Sydney?
Here for work, said Grant. He took a step closer towards her.
Brooke hasn't been returning my calls.
She's got a lot on her mind.
I know that. It's just, I thought the police might have contacted me by now.
Why would they contact you? Asked Inez.
I was part of that family for a long time.
Sure, but that was a while ago now.
Not that long, said Grant.
I have information.
Oh, please.
Inez dropped all politeness in a fit of irritability. If you've really got information, Grant, that might help the police find Joy, call them with it.
I should probably do that, said Grant. I just feel like I have a responsibility to make sure someone has told the police that Joy once...
He licked his lips.
Had an indiscretion.
Inez met her mother's widened eyes.
An indiscretion?
That's right. It was many years ago, but obviously if Stan somehow discovered it, well, that might go to motive.
Go to motive. The man was a geologist, not a lawyer.
I'm sure the family have passed on all the information the police need, began Inez. Brooke is the only one in that family who knows about this particular incident, and she's always been a daddy's girl. I'm guessing she won't be telling the police.
Right, said Inez. She felt sick. How dare he?
I mean, Brooke has her dad's back, and I get that, said Grant. But I'm Team Joy, and if Stan hurt her, then I'm going to help put him behind bars.
Chapter 38, Last October.
Turns out your potential scammer is an actual scammer, said Simon Barrington to Amy as she sat at the dining room table rating the cheesiness of a new savoury cheese cracker. Simon took a cracker as he sat down opposite her.
Cheesy, he said.
Overly so? Asked Amy.
I'd say perfectly cheesy.
His words penetrated.
Savannah is a scammer? Seriously?
She noted that although her heart was definitely going over the speed limit, it was doing so in a controlled manner, staying in its lane.
Her therapist, Roger, used a lot of car metaphors.
Simon opened a manila folder. I did an ASIC search.
Clever.
Amy tried to remember what ASIC stood for. Australian Securities and Investments Commission. She's on the disqualified director list. 3 years ago, she was the director of a business that was selling fraudulent tennis memorabilia.
Wait, fraudulent tennis memorabilia? Said Amy. That seems
like a big coincidence, agreed Simon solemnly.
Their eyes met. Amy thought of her father's precious signed tennis ball collection. She'd always wondered if those players really had sat there and signed them themselves.
You think she deliberately targeted my parents? Asked Amy.
I do, said Simon. I think we should go over there.
He held up the file, waved it. Confront Savannah with this. See what she says.
Well, said Amy, I'm really grateful for this, but...
She wavered. This would be the second time he'd been to her family home. He was acting like a boyfriend,
a sweet young boyfriend who deserved an equally sweet young girlfriend. She would break his already broken heart.
"Okay," she said, because simply looking into his clear brown eyes was as cleansing to her soul and calming to her heart rate as half an Ativan washed down with half a glass of wine.
Chapter 39. Now. 3 years ago, this Savannah Pagonis, who at one point went by the name Savannah Smith and may have other aliases, was selling fraudulent tennis memorabilia on the internet, said Ethan to Christina.
Okay then, said Christina. She sat back in her chair, tapping her pen against her teeth.
Tennis memorabilia. She clearly didn't pick the house at random the way she said she did.
She was trying to scam them, guessed Ethan. Something to do with the tennis school?
Maybe, said Christina, and maybe she was successful. Because whenever I hear the name Savannah from anyone in that family, I get the sense she had some kind of emotional impact.
Like they're angry with her? Asked Ethan. Christina considered his question.
No, she said finally. More like they're sad and possibly guilty?
Chapter 40. Last October. Joy stood outside Savannah's bedroom and pushed tentatively on the half-open door. When Amy was a child, and this was her bedroom, Joy hadn't hesitated to do some sleuthing when Amy was safely at school, searching for clues that would solve the mystery of her daughter. She never found much. A packet of ordinary cigarettes, one funny cigarette, a bottle of creme de menthe that Amy had stolen from her grandmother's house. None of these items came close to what she found under Troy's bed. Joy had been far more distressed by the confusing, rambling diary entries that were so difficult to decipher because Amy had a habit of scribbling over the most important words. I am really worried about scribble, scribble, and scribble. I wish I never scribble with scribble. But Savannah was her guest, and Joy had no parental rights to justify her actions. The only justifications she had were Logan's bizarre accusation about the television documentary he'd seen on TV the other day and the gently ringing alarm bells in her own head. Savannah was not at home right now. She'd announced earlier today that she was going out.
Where are you off to? Joy had asked. Do you need a lift?
Apparently Savannah was having dinner with a friend, and she didn't need a lift. She'd walk to the station and catch the train into the city. Joy had managed to stop herself asking, what time will you be home? Savannah had suggested that Joy and Stan eat the leftover cottage pie from the night before, and she'd even prepared a pea, fennel and feta salad before she went, leaving the good salad servers resting conveniently on the drum-tight piece of cling film, as if Joy and Stan were her children, incapable of finding the right cutlery in their own home. It was very sweet. It was peculiar without her in the house. For such a small, quietly spoken person, Savannah's absence was strangely noticeable. Joy felt as if a spell had been broken. There was a buzzing sensation in her ears, as if she'd walked out of an intense movie or a loud party. She didn't really believe that Savannah was out with a friend. She couldn't even imagine her having a friend. What sort of friend? That was the problem. She was so very fond of Savannah, but she didn't understand her. She didn't really know her. All she had were these tiny jigsaw pieces of a personality that didn't fit together. A love of cooking and a dislike of eating. Classical ballet and foster care. Grandmotherly manners
and a tattoo of a vine. Joy wasn't angry or frightened, but she did want the facts before her children proudly presented her with them, which she suspected they desperately wanted to do. Brooke had made such a big deal about the fact that Joy had initially said Savannah's surname was Polanski rather than Pagonis, which could happen to anyone. She'd acted as if Joy was a dithery old lady. Joy had reminded her that Brooke had believed that carpenters laid carpet until she was 16, and Brooke said, "That was actually a completely logical assumption, Mum." And Joy said, "So, Jesus laid carpet then, did he, Brooke?" Remarkably, they'd both got the giggles at that point. It was nice to hear Brooke laugh. She had a lovely laugh. Grant was very witty, very clever, but he never seemed to make Brooke laugh like that. She had a lightweight doona folded up under her arm as an excuse should Savannah suddenly, impossibly, materialise and catch her snooping. "The nights are getting warmer," she'd say. It was also in case Stan caught her. She didn't want him to know that she had any concerns about Savannah. He already seemed to have turned against the girl. As she stepped into the room, the house phone rang and she gasped as if there had been an explosion. "For goodness sake." "Can you get that?" she called as the phone stopped mid-ring and she heard the deep rumble of Stan's voice. Good. That was him out of the way. It would either be for him or a telemarketer, not Joy. Everyone called her on her mobile because she was progressive. Savannah's room was spick and span, in stark contrast to the cyclonic aftermath that appeared when Amy lived here, both as a child and when she intermittently moved back in as an adult. Savannah's bed was made with hospital corners, the covers pulled army straight, and the windowsills and skirting boards gleamed in a way that neither Joy nor good old Barb ever achieved. Amy's old school desk was clear, except for a foolscap-sized hard-bound journal, sitting right there in the middle of the desk, with a pen next to it. Well, if it was a diary, Joy certainly would not read it. Absolutely not. That sort of gross invasion of privacy was only appropriate for one's own children. Anyway, hadn't Savannah implied that the problem was that she remembered too much about her past? She wouldn't need to record her days if they were permanently recorded in her memory. Joy looked over her shoulder, walked towards the desk. She would not look. There was no point in looking. It was not a diary. If Savannah had something to hide, she wouldn't leave it there in plain sight. Who was she kidding? Of course she was going to look. She flipped open the book. The pages were covered in tiny, rigid handwriting. She put her fingertips to the page. The surface was bumpy. Joy's mother used to write like that, pressing so hard with her pen it left an imprint on the page, as if she were trying to engrave her words forever. She squinted. She needed her reading glasses. Heavens to bloody Betsy! Leaving the room to retrieve her glasses made the whole process feel too calculated. Perhaps if she got them fast. She darted from the room, ran down the hallway. She could hear Stan on the phone. His voice was raised. She hoped he wasn't telling off some poor telemarketer who was only trying to earn a living. She retrieved the glasses from the kitchen table, ran back down the hallway. He was properly shouting now. She dithered. Should she go and try to help sort it out? But the volume of his voice dropped, became conciliatory. That was Stan. The telemarketer might even be making a sale now. She went back into Savannah's room, put on her glasses and picked up the book. Right then. She read, "Sunday. Quarter apple, 5 sultanas, 1 times toast. No crusts, no butter. Bolognese pasta, 11 spoonfuls. Half orange." Day after day it went. Detailed listings of tiny portions of food. She flipped to the last page and saw the beginning of that day's entry. All it said was, 8 spoonfuls of chia yogurt pudding. Savannah had made the chia yogurt pudding last night. It was delicious. Joy must have had at least 100 spoonfuls. She closed the book and carefully placed it back in exactly the position she'd found it. All that time, Savannah spent creating beautiful food, and then she came back to her room and recorded every mouthful in bleak, rigid detail. The pleasure she'd given Joy and Stan with her cooking. It was almost humiliating how much pleasure Joy had taken in it, especially when contrasted with this disciplined transcription. She sat on Savannah's perfectly made bed and pressed her palms to the tightly pulled sheets. Oh, darling, what's going on in that head of yours? It wasn't a surprise, not really. She'd seen the way Savannah swirled the same spoonful of food around her plate, putting it down and picking it up again. Was she suffering from a full-blown eating disorder? Or was it just a strange, compulsive habit to record everything she ate that made her feel in control of her life? Joy's first instinct was to fix it, to get Savannah in to see a professional. As if that would be the silver bullet. It was exactly the way she'd felt when Amy was growing up. They would wait and wait, sometimes months, to get the next available appointment to see the next person. All those different diagnoses they were offered with varying degrees of confidence. She remembered that nice, tired-looking psychologist who, when Joy said, "You lot keep changing your mind," replied, "Ours is not an exact science, Joy. It's not like she has a headache." Joy had thought resentfully, "Well, no one can bloody well fix headaches either."
"Where are you?" shouted Stan. She could hear his heavy footsteps pounding through the house.
"In Savannah's room," she called back.
"You mean Amy's room," he said furiously in the doorway.
"Amy doesn't live here," said Joy. She looked up at him. His face was white, his eyes red. He radiated fury.